Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Smash the like button.
Smash the like button.
Right or now. Else right I will come through this webcam. I'll come at you like a spider monkey.
Oh, look, and we are saved by the music once again. Hi, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. I could have done that all day.
I don't even know what a spider monkey is.
Saying.
This is, of course, Make Me Smart. It's our podcast. It's a thing we do.
It is. It's our podcast where every week we just come together. We try to connect the dots on tech and economics and sometimes a little culture. And of course, you help us do it because, as we like to say, none of us is as smart as all of us.
We are going well outside our area of expertise today. We're going to get international economics today. We're going to do India, its economy, its elections, technology there. They just had elections a week, 10 days ago. 900 million people were eligible to vote. Hello. Prime Minister Narendra Modi was reelected in a overwhelming fashion. It's a huge ally of yours. It's the biggest democracy in the world. It's over there in that part of the world where, oh, by the way, China is. And so that's an issue. But it is not an economy that is untroubled, right? It's grown really fast, but jobs and education are an issue. Unemployment's really high. There's lots going on over there.
Yeah. And then, of course, our administration may have troubled that economy a little bit more. President Trump announced he's ending special trade status for India starting this week. So that affects billions of dollars of Indian goods that have been coming into the U.S. duty-free. And then, of course, there's my beat, the tech side of things, which encompasses a whole bunch of topics in India, not least of which is, of course, that India has long provided tech talent, customer service, lots of startup CEOs in the United States and Silicon Valley. And then, of course, as a market, it's long been coveted because of those 900 million people that Kai mentioned. And also, as that kind of Chinese curtain slams down, it's a pretty crucial player for lots of these American companies who are hoping to grow. So that's why we care. And on top of that, like, not only is it super interesting and relevant, we have like the best expert to talk to, totally our BBC do. Colleague, Anu Anand. She's based in London. She hosts our first newscast of the Marketplace Morning Report. And she just finished a reporting trip to India where she also lived and worked in the past. And she's going to tell us what is what. Hey, Anu.
Hey, Molly.
So how long were you on the ground over there? It was like 10 days, 2 weeks, right?
So we were there for about 2 weeks, wow. But, you know, I've spent about, a large chunk of the last 20 years going to and from India, living in India, lived there for 6 years in a row, but lived there before that. So I was there before it opened up to the rest of the world economically. I've been there through all the crazy changes. And yeah, this election was fascinating.
What, set that up for us, for people who weren't necessarily following it. Why was it fascinating? What were the stakes?
So, Molly, you guys have sort of, you know, set it up. India is a huge market. Just to give you an idea, it's a third the size of the U.S. in terms of the space, but with three times the people, right? So you've got cheek by jowl, the world's wealthiest people, the world's poorest people. You've got some of the smartest people in the world. Like you're saying, you know, Silicon Valley is filled with some of the most highly educated, innovative Indians. But you've also got, you know, this vast population of semi-literate, illiterate people who work for like $1, $2 a day. And the rate of change has just been extraordinary. I mean, my grandparents lived through India becoming independent. My parents lived through the 60s and 70s where India was trying to establish its identity and its economic identity. And I've gone back and forth to India since the late 1990s when finally it opened up to the rest of the world. So it went from a place where there were one or two kinds of cars, all Indian made. There were, you know, the state controlled, the government controlled telephone lines. So you had to wait 8 months before you could get one. It controlled utilities. When I first moved to India in 96, I couldn't get a telephone line. You know, I had to buy a gas cylinder to do my cooking on the black market. So everything was state controlled. And consumer goods. I mean, I remember wandering into, you know, shops where you might find one packet of cookies or, you know, from outside of India, or maybe some super glue, or maybe a thing of deodorant, you know. So it was a very different place, right? And I remember in 1997 in Delhi when, you know, the first Italian restaurant opened, could suddenly, you know, Italian meats and cheeses could come in. And of course, today, I mean, you know, India, Delhi, I mean, it's bursting with international brands, it's bursting with companies. So the rate of change just over the last, 20 years has been extraordinary. And then the political change in this election, Narendra Modi is kind of the culmination of both an economic aspiration, but also a Hindu identity aspiration. You know, my grandfather on my mom's side was kind of part of that movement. He was a very proud Hindu. He was very passionate about cow protection. And there was this sense that all those leaders that had brought India to independence, you know, they were patriots, but they didn't represent Indians. They were pretty elite. They'd been educated in foreign countries. And so Narendra Modi is a very different kind of leader. And in this election, not only, you know, not only did he win last time, and that was pretty unprecedented, but this time the scale of the win seems to cement, you know, the fact that people want economic reform. We can talk more about that. They want different kinds of economic reform, depends on who you ask. But also they want to assert this identity that we are a nation that is majority Hindu, that we have that identity. It's a key part of our identity. So there's all these interesting economic and identity issues. And yeah, I think people were pretty surprised, not that he won, but by the scale of his victory. Yeah. And I think that tells you a lot as well about, you know, his strengths and perceived weaknesses as well.
So give us the economic snapshot then, right? It's a growing economy, but with some cracks and fissures, if you will.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely, Kai. I mean, it's, you know, 1.3 billion people. You know, the tech sector used to represent about 2% of the economy. Now it's maybe 7%. So, you know, when you see those headlines about India's growing economy, what you're looking at is a very small slice of the pie. If you look at the country as a whole, you've got 1 million people coming of age every month. So over a year, you're talking about 8 million new jobs that you need. 8 million new jobs just to absorb the incoming workforce. 80% of the workforce is in what we call the informal sector. So there's no contracts, there's no minimum wage, no protections that go along with it. These are agricultural laborers, domestic workers, you know, people who don't exist on paper. So, you know, they're dealing with their own kinds of problems. And then you've had that 20% that's in the formal sector, you know, the ones that are in, you know, registered legal companies with contracts and all that, unemployment in that part of the economy, according to leaked government data, hit the worst it's been in 45 years between 2016 and 2017. So, you know, it's a growing economy. It's grown at 6 to 7%, although just recently growth hit a paltry 5.8% officially. Some would say it may be lower, you know. But India is a big country, so it needs that massive growth just to absorb its population. So you've got a prime minister who said, I'm going to create jobs, I'm going to bring in reforms. He's had a mixed record. He's done some really amazing things and some things have gone very badly. But the main problem in India is the population, the need for jobs, the need for education. And then you've got a global slowdown as well. So there's a mix of global and domestic problems going on.
Wow. Well, let's talk, this is self-serving, but let's talk about the tech industry as a potential driver of that growth. Because India has a very interesting relationship, as do lots of parts of the world, but with American tech companies in particular. I mean, I remember when Facebook several years ago, around 2013 or so, was wanting to roll out its kind of internet for developing countries, where it said, look, we'll go in and we'll provide this Facebook service and we'll choose these sites and it'll be a few different sites, all operated by Facebook. And India asserted net neutrality and
absolutely
said, absolutely not, right? And that was like this bellwether for how India has really approached these companies, which is much like the EU. You're not going to come in here and take over, no matter what economic opportunity you might represent.
Yeah, and I think the tech sector is interesting because it represents that push and pull between India wanting to open up, wanting to engage with the rest of the world, wanting to grow, wanting foreign direct investment from, you know, big outside companies, but also needing to protect its turf. It's a developing country. There are a lot of poor people. There's a lot of developing industry. I will say this, Molly, I hate to burst your bubble, but tech is not really a driver of jobs in India, you know, because it's so small. It requires a very educated, you know, workforce, and education opportunity is so poor in India still. Tech is not, it's not going to be a driver of jobs. The sectors that drive jobs are really labor intensive. So construction, agriculture, you know, textiles. But, you have hit on something there in that, you know, India wants to harness that growing tech sector to its own advantage. So in a funny kind of way, so right now, you know, you've got a draft legislation on e-commerce, for example, right? So India kind of, you know, welcomed Walmart in to do a deal with Flipkart. They've become joint venture partners. That's great because it brings all this investment into India. But then they've been, you know, going, well, hang on a second. We've got all this data. You know, we need to rewrite the rules on data. We need to keep this data local. We need to monetize the data. They've had to separate out the platform, which is obviously, you know, what the tech sector from America, say, brings in and is really good at, from the actual selling of stuff, because that affects a lot of Indian retailers, a lot of small shops, a lot of, you know, the backbone of both India's electorate and its economy. So you've got to bring in the tech platform because you want that. You want that technology, that, you know, that expertise. But you don't want to undercut with these huge discounts that the likes of Walmart and Amazon have, you know, all of these smaller retailers and companies who are going, wait a minute, we don't have that advantage. We're still, you know, in a developing economy. So there's this real trying to work out how you kind of make the best of both the outside money and the competition while trying to benefit Indian businesses, Indian consumers. So tech is interesting and it's evolving. And so it will be interesting to see where things go in this next administration. A lot of Indian tech entrepreneurs are saying, we should be more like China. China didn't let in any competition. China, you know, China protected its turf and look where China is. So again,
that's
gotta
be terrifying if you're Apple.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because you're already thinking, I can't sell in China as well as I used to be able to. And now India might close the doors too.
But let's keep going with the China thing, right? Because if you take, let's set political systems aside here for just a second, right? And talk about velocity of development, size of the population, which lends itself to potential for economic growth. Are there parallels to be drawn between what has happened in China? I'm not saying China's, you know, all that, but it's made amazing strides in the last generation. Are there parallels to be drawn, Anu, with India?
Well, I think there's a real debate within India. On the one hand, there's a real pride that this is the world's largest democracy, that it holds a peaceful election. 900 million eligible voters can have their say. You know, so that's wonderful. But there is also this undercurrent of envy that China is able to make decisions from the top down. And it can tackle really difficult problems, you know, in a really organized way, right? And so I think the appeal of Prime Minister Modi has partly been this image that he is a bit of a strong man, you know, that he is individually powerful enough and charismatic enough as a leader to sort of tame the wild Indian political system. You know, someone once said that India needs a treaty with itself because, you know, before 1947, before it got independence, India was a collection of princely states and, you know, all these small communities. I mean, you know, the British sort of gave it some order, but it's got 16 languages. It's got so many different religions and identities. And so, you know, there's this both this sort of celebration of that diversity, but also this yearning that somebody needs to come and put, you know, some kind of order to this. So China, yeah, China's, they both admire China, but they also sort of go, well, at least we're a democracy, you know, and I think there's a real conflict going on there about which bits of China to emulate. Well,
you know, it's interesting, just on the whole Modi charismatic, you know, inspirational, aspirational leader, they're saying the same thing about President Xi in China, right? And now he's effectively president for life. Just saying.
Yeah. Right? I mean, yeah. I mean, I think the parallel, the only parallel there is that I think people worry now about how much Prime Minister Modi is going to be tempered by whatever is left of the opposition. And when I say tempered, I mean, you know, things like, you know, religious violence, and that has gone up since 2014. He's been largely silent about that. And, you know, you can argue that on many different levels, moral levels, social levels, but economic levels as well. So, again, how much is he going to, you know, how aggressive is he going to be with economic reform? There are signs that he's going to go a little bit more slowly because, you know, it's complicated to change things, as we saw with things like demonetization, where he withdrew 80% of the currency and it was supposed to cure corruption. And in fact, it lowered growth and got rid of loads of jobs, you know. So he's going to take it slower. And then on things on the social front, you know, are the worst sides of that Hindu nationalism going to come to the fore, or, you know, are we going to see more moderation, more reconciliation? It's a big open question.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, on the social front too, I want to ask you about women, which is one of the stories you did for us about how women hold the key really to that economic growth. But of course, the societal structure is not set up for women to prosper, to be educated, to get these jobs, and to contribute to ultimately a strong economy. What are Modi's views on that?
So he hasn't been very, very vocal necessarily on the issue of women. I mean, I think generally in India, the political classes agree that, you know, safety of women has been kind of a big, big issue nationally and in lots of different towns and cities and states. So I don't think he's against that, certainly. And when we talk about women, or really when we talk about anything in India, you know, it's so complicated, Molly. I mean, if you go to, you know, South Delhi neighborhoods or you know, the center of Mumbai, where everybody's educated, English speaking, relatively well off, you know, you're talking about a whole different set of people than when you talk about women who are doing unpaid labor on farms, have no freedoms, you know, don't get an education, don't get fed in the same way. You know, so we're talking about very different Indias. But, you know, the point is that 3/4 of the population is rural, you know, and that includes a lot of women who are not getting access to education. And in a tough economy, they also aren't getting the jobs because, you know, the men are going to be the first to go and look for jobs. Some people say that if women participated in the economy, and India has a very low participation, female employment, you know, India has a very low participation rate when it comes to women in the economy, that GDP could increase by double digits. But again, the same barriers apply. Education, we did a story about women just next door to Delhi, just a few miles from where Google and all these big international companies have these gleaming new headquarters. And it's, you know, it's pretty medieval. The women wake up at the crack of dawn. They look after the cattle. They do all the cooking. They do all the cleaning. And they do not move out of the house without someone chaperoning them and without permission. And the whole family has to get involved, you know. And so we were looking at a vocational training school that has been doing years of work in these communities just to say, hey, look, trust us. We're run by women. Your daughters, your sisters, your mothers will be safe. Let them learn a skill. Let them work. And it was really interesting because most of the facility was empty because they're still trying to convince everyone. And even after these women successfully complete the, say, year-long training, they get a placement and the family say, oh, no, you can't go out and work. You know that. No, you can't do that. It's unsafe. It's not right. Women shouldn't be out mingling with, you know, strangers. And so, you know, it's mixed progress. Some of them then open their own shops, you know, but not everyone has the means to do that. So, yeah, women, the participation rate for women definitely needs to go up. One thing you really notice in Delhi is there are no women running shops. There are very few women driving Ubers or buses. And, you know, I had two people say to me, I just had a female Uber driver. And it's like, we're like, you know, we're like sharing this news on WhatsApp. Like, oh, somebody get her number. Can we talk to her? You know, because you want to know, well, how did she do that? You know, what barriers did she have to overcome? So I think with Modi, I mean, he certainly, I think, wants to kind of lift everyone up, and including women, but hasn't necessarily done anything specifically on that. But I do think that's an evolving area that, you know, I think most political classes in India are trying to address that gender gap.
So he's got a 5-year term, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so in 5 years, just as a way to wrap things up here, in 5 years, where are we going to be?
Wow. Well, that's, as I say, it's a big open question. I'll tell you what he needs to do in 5 years. He needs to drive more foreign investment because that growth is slowing. And in order to do that, he needs a lot of reform, labor reform, land reform, legal reform. He has introduced bankruptcy reform, and that's good. He has rationalized taxes. Before, you know, if you were moving goods from one state to another in India, you would be stopped at every state border. You would spend hours filling out paperwork, paying taxes to different states, and he's made that one kind of national system. He's going to have to try and offer some relief to farmers. They want better credit. They're struggling with debt. They want minimum price guarantees. He's going to need to narrow the budget deficit, which is 3.4%. And he's got to boost domestic consumption. And, you know, all of this is hard in a country of 1.3 billion people. I mean, you know, it's not just him. It would be hard for anyone. So he's got to navigate all of that. And it really matters. It really, really matters because unlike a developed country where, you know, everybody's got clean water, everyone's got electricity, everyone has a crack at some kind of public education, India's got to have that tax revenue, that income to fix some of these ground level problems. Kai, I'll leave you with one thing,
okay.
You know, because we looked a lot at education as well.
Yep.
And this just, everything to me in India comes back to education. India spends 3% of its GDP on education, on public education. And there's a real debate about whether education should be publicly funded or whether the private sector should move in. And, you know, I always think about South Korea. In the 1950s, India and South Korea kind of started off around the same demographics, the same national income, the same problems, same structural issues. South Korea spent a lot more on healthcare and education, and India didn't. And you can see where you end up when you do that. So I think another thing that's just not being spoken about is he's got to boost education spending, not just on primary education, but on creating thousands of new universities, thousands of technical colleges, vocational education, all of that. And it's really going to take a couple of generations for that to kick in and for all of these different strands of the Indian economy and all these different challenges to bear fruit and to become a China, you know, because there isn't that authoritarian President Xi kind of just going, right. All right, we're going to do this. We're going to do it like right now.
Right. Anu Anand hosts the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. All the stories from her India reporting trip are on our website, marketplace.org. Anu, that was fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks, Molly. Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Anu. We'll talk to you soon. There you go. You'll learn something every day on this show. That's all
I know. I don't think she was trying to argue for president for life, but...
No, but, look.
You do think to yourself.
The scale of the problems, right?
Yeah.
The scale of the problems are enormous.
Yeah.
Are enormous.
Yeah.
And she's so
that
good.
Laundry list. I wouldn't want that laundry list.
She's so good. Yeah.
So
let us know actually what you think about India and why you think it matters, because I think empirically it does, right? She's made that case, but I'd be curious to see what people think. You know,
well, it is one of those countries that matters a whole lot, and we just don't talk.
Just don't talk about it.
Yep. And it's so interesting, and I it's just fascinating. Yes. So please tell us your thoughts. Whatever our website is,
makemesmartmarketplace.org. Yeah, we host the program. Speaking of which, we have something to tell you people.
We do.
We are going to have our own weekly newsletter. Believe it or not.
We make me smart. It's just for us.
Yes.
It's our gift to you. I'm very excited about this. It's launching this Friday. The idea is it's just going to be like a nice little compendium of ways to get smart about the news of the week. So it's not going to be based on our episodes and will not repeat
that you've already heard.
Yeah. It's like it's new, cool stuff that you can understand better or learn about. Like it has awesome little weirdo nuggets. Like it's just...
Cool.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. And also, it looks really good, by the way. Sorry, I saw a mock-up. It looks really cool. And
it's super pretty.
How newsletters look matters, actually.
Yeah,
it's true.
Without a doubt.
It's true.
So it launches this Friday. Like I said, you, the Make Me Smart community, our gift to you. You get to be the first ones to sign up and then tell us what you like.
What you like.
And possibly what you would like to see more of, areas of improvement. We're open to that as well.
That we might
challenges.
Yes, you can sign up. You can subscribe, I think is the word, to the new Make Me Smart newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. And we'll get it to you on Fridays.
I think there might even be more there, but you should just get the Make Me Smart one because it's going to be so good. Marketplace.org/newsletters. All right, we are going to take a quick break during which I'm going to uncover what my news fix is going to be.
I was
going to
bust you, but you just busted yourself. Molly Wood again, shirking her responsibility to listen.
We'll be right back. Bye. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
Don't look at me, yo.
I mean, take as long as you want with that break. I'm still working here.
No, look, it's you're the one who's bringing us back.
I know.
You were trying to do your homework and answer the questions
know.
At the same time.
I'm not going to lie. I actually, that was my own little joke with myself, was just to be like, what? Who? I'm just working on my news fix. I don't know what you guys are doing.
All right, go ahead.
A podcast?
Since it's so fresh in your mind.
It is fresh in my mind. I mean, look, I had to spend the whole... It's amazing how, in some ways, I'm so far away from my consumer technology roots, and then in other ways, I'm like, I'm spending the whole day on WWDC.
Yep.
Which
for the uninitiated,
is Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, where they roll out a whole slew of things and lately, honestly, roll out a whole slew of things that try to convince you that they still have like a plan as opposed to a million different plans in which they hope will become the next iPhone.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting and there was a lot of focus on privacy and I think that's really important, but let's be honest. The only thing that matters right now is this entire, and I put in the wrong link, but the only thing that matters right now is this entire blow up about antitrust. Like, how on the money were we with our episode 2 weeks ago?
Very on the money.
Because that, as much as we thought it might be federal privacy regulation, or we might, you know, it might have been about advertising, might have been about this or that, it turns out that antitrust really is emerging as the tool that government regulators are likely to, and maybe even lawmakers are likely to use to come after these tech companies. And so yesterday, there was a bunch of news about how the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department are essentially divvying up jurisdiction about who's going to be able to take on these companies and how. And then almost immediately after, there was news that the House might start investigating antitrust allegations. So really, this is going to require like a rewriting of the law and a conversation about what is anti-competitive behavior at a tech behemoth versus sort of a classic monopoly.
Right.
And you saw Tim Cook already, immediately in an interview after the keynote addresses yesterday, have to go on CBS News and say, we're not a monopoly. Which is what Mark Zuckerberg also said, right? Mark Zuckerberg was like, oh, there's like six different ways to do social media. And I just think like that distinction, monopoly versus anti-competitive behemoth, is about to become a lot more legally interesting.
So let me ask you, so the companies in question, just to make sure everybody's up to speed, are Facebook, Amazon, Google, and as of yesterday, in this mix is Apple.
Yeah.
Do you believe that this divvying up of jurisdictions, as it were, presupposes action, or are they just kind of, do you think anything's going to happen is the question?
I know. I mean, that is sort of the ongoing question. So just to specify, the divvying landed like this, that the Federal Trade Commission, it looks like, will have jurisdiction over investigating Facebook, with whom it already has a consent decree, and Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Justice Department would take on these questions of anti-competitive behavior and monopolistic behavior with Google and Apple. Now, I got to say, I feel like that seems more likely because there is already evident, you know, there have already been fines and rulings in Europe that mm-hmm. Google has engaged in anti-competitive mm-hmm. behavior. It's been much closer to a monopoly in terms of search. And I think Apple, you could argue, has also, I said this on your show yesterday, but like mm-hmm. everything that Microsoft got sued for in the 90s, Apple has done all along. They just weren't big enough for it to matter.
So let's back up for a second to that Microsoft comparison, which you made on the Aaron Marketplace yesterday. And the mm-hmm. thing you said, which caught me, was Microsoft lost a decade of innovation because, in essence, it was fighting all of this.
Yeah. I think there is likely. So to answer your question directly, I think there's a far higher likelihood that the Justice Department will act against Apple and Google than I think the FTC, because they seem like a little toothless, all due mm-hmm. respect mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to the FTC. And if that happens, I think it is really going to be problematic for these companies because it's years of back and forth,
mm-hmm.
regardless of what the remedy ends up being. I mean, Microsoft didn't get broken up, but it almost did and had to litigate that for another few years. And a lot of people believe that that's why, you know, Microsoft missed the boat on smartphones or didn't come to the cloud until later, and that everything Satya Nadella has done since, basically, is to try to put the company back in a position that it might have otherwise been in.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to see what happens. We're going to see what happens.
Phew. Yeah, I did. I pulled it off.
You did. You did.
I pulled off
my
fix.
Look, I mean, come on. This is you eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff. You know this stuff.
This was an easy one, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, your turn.
Mine is a speech by Jay Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve System of the United States, chairman of the board, of the Board of Governors. He gave a speech this morning in which he said, in essence, holy cow, this trade stuff is bad. And if it keeps being bad, the Fed's going to cut rates. And I mentioned that for two, maybe three reasons. Yeah. Two, maybe three reasons. Number one, it's interesting that Chairman Powell is being that open about the things that are driving decision making at the Fed. As we've said, he's very data driven and he's looking at numbers and they're not great. And that's what he said. There are two other things that are interesting, though. As I speak right now, CNBC has just gone off to commercial. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up something like 400 points on Powell's remarks because Powell is going to cut interest rates, which gets me to the president of the United States. The president of the United States has been very vocal about two things. One, the stock market when it's going up. And number two, the Federal Reserve and interest rates and how he wants them cut. And so what you see happening now is that the president's trade policies are driving the Federal Reserve, because they are doing economic damage, they are driving the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates. And Wall Street is looking at the Fed cutting interest rates saying, party time, my brothers and sisters, come on, money's free again, right? And that's what's happening. And to go back to a previous thing that I talked about a couple of weeks ago, as long as the stock market is rallying, or more properly, not cratering, there is no incentive for the president to change his trade policy actions because he is not being punished by the metric that he understands, which is the stock market. I hope that makes sense to everybody.
It does. Okay. And it starts to get a little nihilistic, too.
Yeah, sure does. You better believe it. You better believe it.
So all potentially, I mean, the trade actions, many of them, certainly the ones with Mexico, appear to be political in nature.
Yes,
like where the president is invoking this sort of national security argument to make what appear to be politically motivated trade moves.
That is correct.
That may have that arguably have a double goal, right? Force the Fed to lower interest rates.
Yep.
And carry out a political agenda.
Yes.
And I'm new to this, but that doesn't feel like how financial policy is supposed to work.
It's not. None of this is normal. None of this is normal. So there you go. So that's what that is. I'm just telling you. All right, so the Dow is up 458 right now. S&P is up, 1.8%. Apple shares up 3.4%, just for the hell of it.
Great.
So there we go.
Remember
so
when Kai, remember when Kai's New Year's prediction was that nothing was
nothing's
going to
change? And I was mocked. I was mocked.
Was like, nothing's going to matter.
Roundly.
No one's going to wise up. Everybody's going to continue. What I find amazing, and I just like, part of me almost wants to believe it's algorithms, like just a bunch of computers. I find it amazing that the trading class of this country, whoever that even is at this point, it just like takes the bait every time. They're literally like
the dumbest golden retriever that ever ran around the dog park. So let's be honest. There are some people who are actually doing this, but most of this is algorithmically driven. On headlines. So when there's a headline on Bloomberg or the New York Times or the FT that says, President says China trade deal is close, those algorithms go, oh, yippee, and they buy.
We love that.
Yeah. Right?
I want to know. We should do a story about this, actually. Like, why is the call and response so predictable and so arguably
computers.
Unthinking?
Computers.
I mean, yay, then we're safe from the computers for another day. But how come the algorithm, nobody ever goes in there and tweaks the algorithm just a little bit to be like, hey, you know, well, these headlines, they happen every couple hours in response to a tweet. So maybe they're not real information.
Yeah, but the catch is that the algorithms are designed not to ferret out real information, but to make money.
Oh.
Sorry.
This is getting kind of enraging.
Yeah. Oh. There you go. Well,
hi, Kai and Molly.
What?
I like it.
I was wild.
Nice.
Okay. All right, I guess we'll go there now.
Your comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen, my brother. So here we go. Last week, we talked about the Iron Curtain possibly falling between U.S. and China on the whole Huawei thing and technology and what kind of a mess the globally integrated supply chain is going to be as you roll all that into the trade war. Also, listeners tuning in from abroad paid special attention because Huawei has a huge presence in Europe and Australia, which gets us to Sven Feldman, who is clearly via Stockholm, although who knows. From Melbourne, Australia, he sent us this voice memo. He says he saw something happen in Australia. Huawei and ZTE, which we talked about, were banned from providing 5G in Australia last year.
This followed an incident where security cameras made by Chinese companies that were already under scrutiny regarding espionage had been installed at an Air Force base and in a building in the capital, Canberra, that was used by our intelligence agencies.
No big deal.
Right. Pay
no
no
big
attention
deal.
To that camera in the corner. You know,
there's like a bananas story about this too, where they, you know, they interviewed people from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute saying it is a dereliction of duty to have these have installed a surveillance network at sensitive government facilities that is entirely made and manufactured by Chinese companies.
Yeah.
No big.
It's all right.
It seems like fine. It's fine. Listener Adrian Foy lives in Poland. Speaking of people who you, we asked if, do you use Huawei? Adrian uses a Huawei P20 phone and tweeted us about the ban saying, it is ridiculous that Trump and America can impact me while on a different continent with no jurisdiction.
It's a global economy, Adrian. It's a global economy. It's a global economy. I know nothing of Huawei phones.
Oh my God, they're super pretty. Just like come to one of those hilarious big tech conferences with me. You'll love it. Sure. It'll be like your favorite thing ever. And we can look at all the shiny phones.
You and I have different ideas of a good time.
I'm being super sarcastic because you'd rather die.
I would rather die. Okay. But. So now that that's clear, Timothy Ulti was visiting family in the Netherlands not too long ago. They use Huawei phones. And his relative said if they had to pick a side of the digital Iron Curtain to be on, wait for it, they would go with China.
Some of them said the revelations about NSA surveillance were a factor in choosing Huawei. I'm far from naive about the extent of U.S. surveillance of non-U.S. citizens, and aren't anti-China either. But I found it fascinating that people in a Western country like the Netherlands would rather risk being spied on by the Chinese government instead of by the U.S. government.
Ouch.
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 Yeah.
We did get some, I thought, you know, reasonably considered criticism that we did not actually surface the Huawei side of the story in our episode about Huawei, which was them saying, this is ridiculous.
Right.
We are in no way at the behest of the Chinese government. And I actually met someone recently at an event who said he had done a lot of work with Huawei on the network side, and he was like, it's absolutely absurd. It's not happening. It's never happened. There's no, you know, there's no evidence of it happening, and it would be incredibly difficult to engage in that kind of spying after the fact once there was an installation. And he said, and PS, as a network professional, that stuff works. It is really good gear.
So the Huawei, also, you mean the Huawei 5G gear?
The Huawei, all of, well, the networking equipment
writ large,
separate from 5G equipment writ large, right? Because they are currently a provider of all kinds of infrastructure. And a lot of IT professionals are like, look, I'm sorry, but that stuff works. And the phones are really good. And
that's interesting.
Yeah. So fair and important counterpoint there.
Yes. All right.
All right. Make me smart question.
Okay.
Should we do that? Yeah. This one looks like it's going to be, we're going to learn a lot. Because I just peeked ahead. What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Rob Walker is a journalist and a writer who covers like a bunch of stuff, design to the workplace. And he wrote this column in the New York Times called The Workologist. And he has a new book out that I'm dying to read. This is like the greatest title ever. It's called The Art of Noticing. And here's his answer.
So one thing that I thought that I knew is that we have just five senses: sight, hearing, taste, smell, touch, the familiar ones. But it turns out that's not really true, that we have more senses than that. And I learned this sort of in two ways. One really workaday way, like by watching an explainer video. And one example they use that's easy to understand is thermoception, which is the ability to detect temperature differences. And this is why you don't have to touch a flame to feel its heat, to sense its heat. The other way that I sort of learned about this was at the exact same time, a little more highbrow, I was reading about this idea that Marcel Duchamp, the artist, had called the infra-thin, which was something he made up and never really defined, but he would give examples. So his examples included, like, the warmth of a seat that has just been vacated is an example of the infra-thin. So these two things at the same time just changed my mind about the senses that we have. And on a broader level, taught me something about the way that we frame knowledge sometimes shapes knowledge and limits knowledge. And sometimes it's good to reframe or even just throw the frame out and see what that reveals.
Wow.
Right?
I mean, that was cool. I'm not entirely sure I understood all
I'm going to need to listen to that a bunch more times and also click some things and Google some stuff.
And read his book. But yeah. I mean, okay. All right.
Thermoception.
Yep.
And then like a layer called the infra-thin. The infra-thin is amazing. I don't know. Perception. Well, I love it.
So the warmth of the seat that has just been vacated, and this maybe gets a little potty mouth for you, but think about warm toilet seats.
Well, yes.
And, I'm just saying.
Well, and what is your perception of that moment?
Ah, that's my perception of that moment. That's nice.
Or ew. It could also be you.
So anyway, that's Make Me Smart for this week.
I like that. Boy, good job us, by the way, being so smart with our responses. Help us. Help us. Make us smarter. Make me smart at marketplace.org. If you would like to send your answer to the Make Me Smart question and have us talk about.
Or thoughts on thermoception. Okay.
All right.
So
help.
Make Me Smart, produced by Shara Moore. She is not here today. Tony Wagner was in charge. He is also a digital producer. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hetcote and Summer Dunsmore.
This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. I knew it because I heard him earlier. Our theme music was composed by Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. And the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah. Are you out there? Deborah Clark.
You know what's funny, though? You're saying that risk-free. It's totally risk-free. Although one day she's going to like barge in here at the studio at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday and go,
I'm right here.
Right here.
I have this live streamed into my office, you chumps. I'm reading all about thermoreception right now.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah. Wow. It's like about how when you brush your teeth with minty toothpaste, then you feel like your mouth is cold. But it's not. That's thermoreception. And when you eat curry, then your mouth feels hot, but it's not hot.
Well, because it's spicy. It's hot. It's spicy.
Yeah, but it's not actually like the temperature has not raised of your skin. Thermoception.
All right.
This is fascinating.
Okay. All right.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.